I used to go do walking trips with friends, Spain, Kenya, various parts of the world, and I used to make work in the landscape, and I would find wood, hopefully, and the conditions would be right, the weather would be right, and I'd make the work in these landscapes. But the last 8 years, I've been predominantly working here, although I do sometimes take trips abroad, so it's a much stiller kind of activity. The wood material comes to me now. I just wait for it. It's interesting. If you stay in one place, it's amazing what comes to you. It's extraordinary what happens. Although in England, of course, the weather is not always right for me to work, because working with the sun, it varies, and the time of day obviously would affect things. Time of year, altitude can affect it, cloud cover, and then the material I work on, wood, depending on if it's old wood and it's dry, it might burn more quickly. So there are all these sort of combinations.
And the working season is from April till October?
About then, yes. Mm.
So you're in a resting period now, if we're not in April.
Well, I'm not resting. My body's still going on, my brain's still going on. But I'm not actually making work.
Yes.
And so it's a period of, I suppose it's sort of kind of hibernation, but storing up. And sometimes that can be very frustrating. But on the other hand, I quite like that period when you stop working, and then when you start again, it's like the first time, and it keeps it very fresh, and you wonder whether you've lost whatever it is that you had which allowed you to work in the first place, the motivation or the ability. I find that quite exciting. Year in, year out, I get put back in exactly the same position again. Okay, so in a moment we're just going to cut through the sand dune here, and we'll just go down. Now you can see this cutting we're going through.
Roger Ackling was born in London in 1947 and now lives and works from a coast guard's cottage in Norfolk. In this part of England in the early 19th century, there was an important school of English landscape painting, whose most famous members were John Crome and John Sell Cotman. They recorded the local scenery, giving great prominence in their paintings to the sky. In complete contrast, Roger Ackling doesn't give us a pictorial record of the Norfolk landscape, although he does pay particular attention to the weather. He works in the open air and uses elements of the natural world, sunlight, wood, water and wind, but he's not a traditional painter or sculptor, he's more like an engraver. In 1974, he came upon the idea of burning lines into the surface of small pieces of driftwood, using an ordinary magnifying glass to direct the sun's rays. The pieces of wood are usually about a foot in length, and they're scored with rows of burnt parallel lines. Sometimes the work takes an hour to make, and sometimes just a minute. Ackling makes the most economical works of art I've ever encountered, and a retrospective exhibition of his sculpture could be fitted into a briefcase.
I'm not very sympathetic to art where one actually comes to a linguistic understanding of its meaning. I think the more linguistic or the more decipherable a piece of work is, for me it's less meaningful, has less presence. And I like that about this landscape. I'm totally unlike today. I mean, I don't talk in it. I don't think a lot in it. I just actually just experience it.
So your work is likely to always be offered untitled, to not make it too particular or linguistic?
Well, the title usually is some sort of inroad. It
yes.
gives a sort of it gives some access to the work, over and above the work, and I don't like that sort of access. I much prefer the work to be the work, and people respond to it or they can't. But
sometimes you've given the duration of the piece, 1 hour drawing.
Or, yes.
Do you still believe in that?
Well, when I first started working, you see, I didn't know many other people that worked with a magnifying glass, so worked in the way that I did. So I had to start, I suppose, like learning the tools of the trade, and one of them was time, how
yes.
long something took, how long I could hold the glass for, how long it would take, the kind of material I was working on. So a lot of the early work was to do with, it was much more measured. And then the work went through a transition where I think that measurement was related to one's experience of a landscape. So one would work in a landscape for an hour under certain weather conditions at a certain altitude. And now I'm not really interested in those, either the measurement or necessarily trying to sort of sense a landscape. I'm actually more interested in a mental mental state of mind whilst working. And this landscape's a good one, because if you look at now, we're looking out towards the North Sea on a day which is very, it's pretty grey and overcast. I mean, that's one, I mean, that's a thoughtless experience, I think.
Well, it might be for you, but it certainly induces a lot of thoughts for me.
Well, but if you were here 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, of course, you come with a lot. You've been talking.
Yes.
If you're just here by yourself, you get to a period when you just actually experience. Right, we can get down here. We can try. Okay, so we're down on the beach now, and it's a pebble beach. It's a storm beach. It changes a lot, needless to say, because of the tides. And you can see at the back here, it's been very high tides because of this north wind. So the sea's been pushed up because it faces north here. And there's a lot of wood, a lot of plastic, quite a few different sorts of objects. And it's this kind of condition that one would be looking for, really. There's a lot of different things here. But this is pebbled right up to the point where I also walk up. It's a good day's walk there and back, 5 miles up and 5 miles back, walking on pebble. And that's a very beautiful point at the end there, because it's sand at the end. You can't just about see it in the distance. There's a seal colony up there. And up there, unlike this, it starts to turn up to a little bit like Cape Cod, the sand dunes and sand. And the wood gets thrown quite a long way up, and then it gets sandblasted. And it's on the grass, the marron grass. So again, if the wood's been up there, sandblasted, it's a very different kind of treatment that it gets. It gets eroded. And it gets whiter. Here, each tide could literally, if they're high tides, it'll take it up, take it back again, take it up, take it back again.
So this is just pebble washed, the wood here?
Pebble washed, yeah.
Yes.
But what's strange is, I sometimes see a piece maybe 4 miles up the coast. I think, shall I use it? I won't. And then, like, maybe 5 or 6 months go by and I see it again. And I say, no, I'm not interested in it for some reason. Then another couple of months, and I see it again, I think, gosh, 3 times, I'd better pick it up.
Why wouldn't you be interested in a piece of wood? What would make you reject it?
It's it's not something, I'm not being evasive, it's not something I verbalise. I just look at it. And actually, it may be like a piece of wood I've used before and I've enjoyed working.
In shape. And texture.
Yes.
Yes.
And format.
Yes.
Proportions, dimensions. So I might actually pick it up because it reminded me of a piece that I made before. So I could make the same piece again under slightly different conditions. It may be challenging in the sense that it's unlike anything I've seen before. And I think, well, okay, I'll look at that. It may have something on the surface of it. It may have a nail, it may have a stain mark. It's very intuitive. Mm. It's very intuitive. And in fact, about up to 7 years ago, I would never work on a piece of wood that had paint on it because of references to painting. But now I actually quite enjoy pieces of wood with paint on. In this area, the paint usually is from people that have been painting the boats, so you get these extraordinary colours, blues and reds, and rather like allotment doors.
Yarmouth boats.
Yarmouth boats, Sheringham boats, yeah.
Now, you know your working season with the sun is April to October. On a cold grey winter day like this, would you collect wood, or would you just be here?
If there was a high tide and there was a lot of wood about, I'd start looking. Sometimes I just walk on the beach to just have the experience of walking on the beach. But on a day like this, as I say, there's a lot of wood about, and so I'd probably have a look, see if there's any I could use, and then I'd take it back, store it in the garden, and then a good day in April, maybe I'd start.
Ooh.
Oh, that's good. This piece of wood is, I mean, I wouldn't work on this piece. Again, I don't know why, but it's got this lettering, numbers on the side. I don't know what it's been, some old, looks like a child's sword or something, but it's handmade.
It's been whittled, hasn't
whittled
it?
Down.
Yes. Has that got too much life in it already?
It's too active. It looks like it's already something. I like working with things that are really rejected, that no one wants. I like that aspect very much.
Pieces of charred wood. Now, you couldn't really work with charred wood, could you?
You can work on burnt wood, yeah. You can burn on top of burning, but it doesn't leave a visual trace. But that's also quite a beautiful idea, I think, that you work maybe 5 or 6 hours on something, and in the end there's nothing there visually.
But you've made a depression, an engraved line.
You might do, yes. I say that with no visual trace. There might be a very, very faint trace.
You do work like an engraver. So it seems to me it's an equivalent for you burning a line into a piece of wood. You don't add to the wood, you take away.
Well, it's taking away in the sense that, yes, energy is released in the form of smoke and heat, which then returns back to the atmosphere. But it's unlike an engraver in the sense that I'm working with a source which is 93 million miles away. And it goes through space, this source I'm working with, light. And it, just as it's about to hit the Earth, I put this small lens and catch it and focus it down into a point. And then it goes through space again onto the surface. So it's a very physical activity in one sense when you start talking about those dimensions. But it's a very ephemeral one, because the actual amount of contact of anything touching anything else is very minimal. Also, it actually, when you work on a surface, it removes to some degree, but it also, strangely enough, reveals, because sap from wood comes to the surface. Energy inside the wood, which is not immediately apparent visually, actually comes to the fore. And of course, there's this wonderful thing, it's the smoke. In fact, I thought 2 years ago that maybe my work had been the smoke.
Yes.
And in fact, it wasn't what was actually left. Maybe I'd just been working with smoke and been paying attention to the wrong thing.
How much smoke does come off the burning point?
Well, again, it depends on the heat. It depends on the dryness of the wood. I mean, sometimes the wood catches a light. Sometimes, if the wind's in the right direction, you'd hardly see it and the wood was dry. Other times, it actually, like by a bonfire when you're a kid, it actually gets into your eyes and it makes them smart. If the wind's coming onto you and it's a hot day and it's dry wood, then sometimes it's quite difficult to work.
It's said in the few things that are written about that you discovered in 1974 your magnifying glass way of working. Can you tell me about that?
I think one of the great things, as I was saying earlier, this century is that artists are now deciding what art is and the way that people can make work and how meaningful it can be. And because there are so many different ways to make work, it can be very problematic. And I think as you can make work anywhere, anytime, under any conditions, I think what you actually end up doing is very pertinent. So I started working with the glass, which lots of people have done when they were children.
Yes.
And it just seemed to me at the time, having trained or made paintings up to that period, it seemed to me that it was more transient, it was more ephemeral, it was less to do with me, it was less physical, there was more space about. For me, it was more unknown. Also, at the time, I was told that it was a stupid activity, that it wasn't art, it couldn't be meaningful. And for me, it actually has become very, very meaningful. It's one of the great meaningful acts of my life.
And prior to this great discovery...
No, it wasn't a great discovery. No, things don't work like that. They're not great discoveries. They're things you do, and then you can find or not meaning in an activity. I think that's the thing. It takes faith, it takes belief, then it takes a kind of acceptance of reality. And so some of the art I'm interested in is certainly, which again is in the margins of stretching belief, not because people actually want to try and pull a fast one or people are trying to be radical, but they're actually trying to find fresh and expressive ways of actually being and seeing the world and responding to it on the planet.
Because you've introduced the words faith and belief, I'd like to ask you, in a very simple catalogue for the listener in 1981, you put articles of faith and you printed a verse of a hymn. Dear Lord and Father of mankind, speak through the earthquake, wind and fire, O still small voice of calm. That must mean something to you, or it did then. Does it now?
I think we live in a very exciting world. I think there's a lot of information going around. I think there's a lot of interchange. If you're an artist, you come into contact with the art world, fortunately or unfortunately. And I think that to maintain one's position as a human being and one's belief in one's activity, I think it does take an act of being centred and it does take an act of belief. And I tend to associate both those things with stillness and silence. I think another artist maybe would associate, if they did associate with those words, they might associate different qualities to it.
To make your art, you've got to be very still, haven't you? You've got to sit for several hours with your arm in one position.
Yes.
Watching the sun.
I'm watching a spot. I'm watching a black spot on the surface of wood, a rather overexposed photograph of the sun. One dot joins up to another one. One overexposed photograph of the sun falls onto another one, and that dot makes a line, and that line makes a surface. And that surface makes my work.
In some of your lines, they are lines, and in some they do look like dots,
yes.
Quite particular little points. And is that the nature of the day, is it, or the wind? Or
yes, that'll do with the strength of the sun and the nature of the wood. So if I were working in early April at 7 o'clock in the morning on a very hard piece of oak, it would be a lot of dots, it'd be joining up dots. If I was working on the same piece of wood, maybe on a hot day in July, around noon, good atmosphere, those dots would automatically become lines. In fact, I'd have to move quite quickly to actually stop the wood actually catching light.
And how much is premeditated? You look at the weather forecast the night before and see there'll be sun around lunchtime, and then you'd pick a particular piece of wood and say, it's that piece tomorrow and so many hours. Is that the way it happens?
What would happen is that I'd probably be feeling that it's about time to make something. I want to make something. I get up in the morning, I look out, it seems like it's going to be a good day. I know something, because the number of years I've been making, I know something about the English sun in the terms of temperature that I can produce on the surface by this one glass that I use all the time. I've got a rough idea that day of what condition my body's in, whether I can sit for 6 hours, whether I can sit for an hour. So I would choose a surface.
When you're sitting for 6 hours, you've actually got to keep yourself very concentrated.
I used to think that. I used to think that you had to get a strong grip of your mind. And people used to say to me, oh, your work's, you know, some form of meditation. Well, it's not. I now let my mind do whatever it wants to do. And the enjoyable thing is it doesn't do very much. And, of course, I think one of the things which is often not discussed in relationship to landscape is that the outside world, in some ways, is an outer reflection of an inner state. And that the two, for me, when they come together, that seems an ideal moment.
When you're sitting very still, concentrating on the burning point of your work, do you take in other visual material, or do you listen?
Well, what happens, because I'm focused in this activity, and in a sense, even though I'm paying visual attention, I'm sort of working blind, sound becomes very important. And so you hear animals near you. When you sit very still, animals come quite close to you. There's a weasel that comes quite close to me in the garden, birds. But the thing which really registers very strongly, which is linked again from April to October, and it's linked very much with the location of the house in Barley and Wheatfields, is the skylark. And virtually all the work I've made at Webham in the last 7 years has actually been listening to this phenomenal bird's singing. And strange enough, when I stop September, it usually coincides with the harvest. And so this bird is just constantly there. It's absolutely constantly there. In fact, when it's not there, I realise somehow that something's wrong. I worked in Spain once, and it was an interesting landscape outside in the mountains of Toledo. And there was something about the landscape while I was working that wasn't that it troubled me, but there was some significance to it. I just couldn't work out what it was. And it wasn't till the fourth day I realised there was no bird song. They'd all been shot. You'd eat them in bars in the evening.
Did that affect the work?
I don't know whether it affected the work. I think to listen to the skylark certainly raises one's spirits. And then at the end, there becomes again, when one stops and the bird carries on singing, there is this sort of stillness. There is this wonderful sort of, almost as if there's an act of celebrations taking place. And I think this notion of sometimes, again, being on the beach, being by oneself, and also I think looking at a piece of work, silence is very important. And I love that Octavio Paz quote about silence, which is, for those people who hear or think they hear the poem of the universe, they do not hear themselves in that poem except as silence.
Roger Ackling, thank you very much.
Thank you.